Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Mem Zayin Amud Aleph, four lines down. I'm Rabbi Yochanan. Uman in lo chazaka. Obviously, there's no chiddush here. That's our Mishnah that tells us that an uman can't establish a chazaka. Here is the chiddush. Ben uman, yesh lo chazaka. The child of an uman does have the ability to establish a chazaka. Aris in lo chazaka. Once again, that's found in our Mishnah. But Rabbi Yochanan is adding for us, ben aris, yesh lo chazaka. But the son of the aris does have a chazaka. Gazlan. Ubein gazlan ein lahem chazaka. Over here, the din is different, that a thief and the son of a thief do not have the ability to establish a chazaka. Ben beno shel gazlan yesh lo chazaka. On the other hand, the grandchild of the gazlan does have the ability to establish a chazaka. Those are the statements of Rabbi Yochanan. And the Gemara is going to ask right away, Eichidami, what exactly is the scenario over here? Let's clarify the scenario, because it seems to be that there's no consistency in the psak over here, because if they're coming with a claim based on their father, there's no reason why the son of the uman or the son of the aris should have an ability to establish a chazaka. They're coming and saying, my father had this object, my father worked on this field. Neither of those are good chazakot when their fathers are alive, because their fathers can't establish a chazaka. Their father was a craftsman. And a craftsman, the default relationship, unless proved otherwise, is that he's working on the object as a craftsman. And therefore, he can't establish a chazaka. Aris is default interaction with the balabait, with the field, is that of a sharecropper. And therefore, he can't establish a chazaka on the property. Given that, if the child comes and says, I inherited it from my father, that's why it belongs to me, and I've been here for 3 years, it should make no difference. In essence, he has no tana. He's missing a tana completely. His chol chazaka is premised on his father's acquiring or owning the object, but his father's owning of the object is meaningless. So over here, why would you say that a ben aris or a ben uman has the ability to establish a chazaka? So that's the problem with the claim coming from the father. Idlo ata b'tanata davon. If they're not coming with their father's claim, but rather their own claim, I purchased it from you, I bought it from you, then afilu ben gazlan nami. Then why is the son of a gazlan precluded from establishing a chazaka? You have to be consistent over here. If it's the claim coming from the father, then just like the fathers have no ability to establish a chazaka because their claims are not valid, then a child coming with the claim of his father is no better than the father themselves. Given that, none of these individuals, the children, should be able to establish a chazaka. The other way around, if the children are coming with their own independent claim of purchasing the item, then it should be irrelevant whether their father was an uman, aris, or a gazlan. Their father has nothing to do with them. So then why does that impact the ability of a ben gazlan to establish a chazaka? Lo tzricha. So here is the situation. Here we're going to read it with the girsa of the Rashbam. The ka'amre edim, we have edim that come and testify, bifaneinu odelo, that in front of us, he admitted to the fact that there was a sale here, or belongs to the uman or the aris. That the marakamo, the original owner, admits in front of Edim, I sold it to the aris, or I sold it to the uman, or I sold it to gazlan. That admission is sufficient to establish the ownership. Right, so now the son's claim is validated by these Edim. Hanachi kameimar kushta kamre. In terms of the uman and the aris, we would believe that he's telling the truth. Because why would they admit to the fact that they sold this object? The marakama, the original owner, said, I sold it to the iman, I sold it to the aris. Why would he go ahead and admit to that fact, unless it was absolutely true? The fact that he admitted to the edim that it was true substantiates the claim of the child. So when the child comes and makes a claim, it belongs to me because my father owned it, or it belongs to me because my father worked on the field. Either of those will be valid claims because we have corroboration of the father's claim, which otherwise wouldn't have worked, but with Edim, now we have a claim. Hi, Avagav Do'ode, Nami Lo Mehemen. On the other hand, the Gazlan, even if they have an admission by the original owner that he sold it to the Gazlan, it doesn't work, he's not believed, Kidrav Kahana. Because of this position of Kidrav Kahana, which we will bump into again later on today's daf, Tamarav Kahana, Ilav Do'odile, if he didn't admit to the fact that he had sold it to the gazlan, he would have given over his property to the government. The shachavar, as the Rashbam points out over here, is the targum of the word where a government official basically confiscates the property, forced work or forced labor on behalf of the government. So this individual is basically putting him between a rock and a hard place, or blackmailing him and saying, if you don't say that it's mine, if you don't sell it to me, then I'm going to give over your property to the government, or I'm empowered to take it on behalf of the government. So you have two choices. Either you give it to me, or it's gone, and the government's going to press it into labor or into work, and you won't see it again. So he put him in a position where he had to admit. So the difference between the admission by the Uman and the Aris, which is an admission that's not under duress, the only reason he would admit to selling it is because it's true, whereas by the Gazlan, the admission is not an admission. That is the problem. The problem is that we don't believe his admission in those cases. Even when he does it in front of Edim, is because we feel that there's some other duress that's causing him to admit to the fact that he sold it. So now, the problem here is not that a gazlan can't establish a chazaka. The problem is that we can't believe anybody who's speaking to the gazlan or admitting to the fact that he sold to the gazlan, because it's in all likelihood it was done under duress. If it was done under duress, his admission is meaningless in that case. So that is the view of the Rashbam. It's the girsa that we have in our Gemara, is the girsa of the majority of the Rishonim, the Rif, and others. On the other hand, the Baal Yom Tosafot asked the question that David posed and said, what is the Chiddush? Why is there a Chiddush over here? Once you have Edim, of course, Edim are Ra'aya, they are foolproof. If you have Edim, not only could the child of the Aris or the child of the Uman gain access to create a Chazaka, even the Uman himself, or the Aris himself, can, if he brings Raya, if he brings a Shtar, he brings an admission to court, the Uman and the Aris have the capability to establish a Chazaka. They have an ability to prove their ownership over here. We don't deny them the ownership in this case. So that's a huge problem. That's what the Rabbeinu Tam raises in the Baal Yom Tosafot. If you have Edim already, why are we talking about the children of the Aris and the Uman? We may as well talk about the Uman and the Aris themselves. The way you have to answer on behalf of the Rishbam is, Eino Chanami. That is definitely the case. And the whole Chiddush in Rabbi Yochanan's statement has nothing to do with the Aris and the Uman. In Achanami, the Aris and the Uman also would be able to establish a Chazak here. The big Chiddush is the Gazlan. Is the Ben HaGazlan or the Gazlan, that with this admission in front of Edim, it is still not viable. It is not a good admission, and that won't help us. That's not evidence to the fact that he's really sold it to him or gave it to him. So according to the Rashbam, or the reading that we have in the Gemara, the first two statements of Rabbi Yochanan are completely given. They are easy to understand, and not only with the children, but even the Uman and the Aris would have a chazaka. The Chiddush is in the latter part of his statement, which is the Gazlan. In contrast to that, the Gazlan and the Ben HaGazlan will not benefit from the fact that there was an admission over here, because we don't believe the admission. The admission was done under duress, or we assume it was done under duress. Given that, we don't utilize that admission as a piece of evidence, and therefore you can't establish a chazaka as a Gazlan or as a Ben HaGazlan. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Tam leaves out the word Edim in the Gemara, and thereby comes up with a different view or version of this, in which everything is a Chiddush. And that is that the child comes before us in court and says, you admitted in front of my father, and I was present, that you had sold it to him. With Fanai, in front of me, you sold it to my father who was an Uman, you sold it to my father who was an Aris, you sold it to my father who was a Gazlan. Now here's the Chiddush. That even though if the Uman or Aris came along to court and said, you admitted to me that you sold it to me, would have no bearing on the case, because he's a defendant in the case, or here he's the claimant in the case that he bought it, and therefore he has no power to say that you admitted to me without Edim corroborating that evidence. Now then, if the child says, you sold it to my father in front of me, he has now amigo. Because the child can make one of two claims. He could say, you sold it to me directly, or you sold it to my father in front of me. Given that he took the worst of the two claims, the easier claim would have been just to say, you sold it to me, and he would have been done. He would have acquired the property, it would have all been done, because he's not a Uman, he's not an Aris, he's not a Gazlan. He could have bought it that way, and said, I bought it, and he has Shnei Chazaka, it's a good Taina, Shnei Chazaka, he's done. The fact now that he makes the claim that you sold it to my father in front of me, he should be believed, because Migo, he could have bet the better claim, which is that you sold it to me directly, therefore he has a right now to make a statement that you sold it to my father. And that's the Chiddush in that case. Uman and Aris, that wouldn't work. If they themselves said that you sold it to me, we would ignore that, because that's the nature of a relationship. Uman and Aris is that they don't sell it to them. And they're saying you admitted to it has no bearing on the case. The child comes along and says that, that is a good time now for the child. And also Gazlan, that's the Chiddush, the same Chiddush, which is that by the Gazlan, obviously if you admit it to the Gazlan, it's meaningless, but even if the son of the Gazlan says, you admitted to my father that you had sold it to him in front of me, it has no bearing because we don't believe the admission. We believe that the admission was done under duress, and he didn't really say it, he said it because he had no choice in the matter. And so therefore, even when the son comes with that claim, he doesn't have amigo, because the statement is not a valid statement. We don't believe the admission in that case, and therefore it's not a valid claim at all. He has no claim whatsoever. Amigo only works if you have two choices about what you said, and you pick the worst of the choices. But if you pick a choice that's not a claim, you can't say, well, I had the alternative of giving you a really good claim, which was that I bought it from you. Now that I told you a claim that has no validity, it doesn't work. That's what the Rashbam told us earlier. In the second, that the amigo doesn't work in that case. We discussed more extensively how amigo functions, but the way that the Rashbam phrased it back there was, if you come with a Tana that's not a Tana, then you can't say that I had a better claim. You have to have a claim to start with and then say I had a better claim. Over here, the claim is meaningless. When he says that you admitted it in front of my father and I was present, that claim is invalid, period. You can't go then say, oh, I could have said that I bought it directly from you, because you don't even have a claim to start with to say that there's amigo. So that's the chiddush according to Rabbeinu Tam. Obviously, according to Rabbeinu Tam, the chiddush is in both aspects here. There's the Ben Uman and the Ben Aris has the ability through this to gain the amigo and have a chazaka. And the chiddush on the other side is that the Ben Gazlan does not have the ability to establish amigo, or that the claim is completely invalid in that case. Amar Rava, pi'amim shafilu ben benoshel gazlan, nami enlo chazaka. Again, this is the girsa that we have in our text. There was an alternate girsa we'll see in a second. But the way that we have it is, even the grandson of the Gazlan also does not have a chazaka. That's if he comes with a claim to say that the property came to me through my grandfather. If he said the property came to me through my father, then he would be fine. Because it was his grandfather that was the Gazlan. His father wasn't the Gazlan. So if he says that it came from my father, we would be toying on his behalf. We would claim on his behalf that his father bought it from the seller, from the original owner, and that's how it came into his possession. We wouldn't assume that his father inherited it from his grandfather that was a Gazlan. On the other hand, if the grandson says, the property came to me through my grandfather, and his grandfather was a Gazlan, then he's no better than his father coming with his grandfather's claim, because he is coming from a Gazlan. His whole claim derives from a Gazlan, and therefore he has no power to make a claim over here. That's the way you would have to explain it. There are others who do not like this explanation, because why should the Ben Beno have any problem? The answer is what I said, that he came with the grandfather's claim rather than his father's claim. And that would say, even Rabbi Yochanan's statement that the Ben Beno is free and clear, and he can establish a chazaka, sometimes that's not true. Now the alternate girsas brought by the Rashbam and the Balei HaTosafot, and as well the Rashbam and the Balei HaTosafot bring the alternate girsa. Tosafot rejects this girsa, but the Rashbam supports the girsa that we have, but then brings the alternate girsa as well. Venir the read, the Garas, Pamim she ben gazlan yesh lo chazaka. That the alternate girsa was that the son of a Gazlan does have the ability to establish a chazakah. Rabbi Yochanan says you can't. So how here does a ben Gazlan have the ability to establish a chazakah? He comes with a claim through his grandfather. He says, the property that I'm in, why am I here? It's because I came from my grandfather. So in that case, his grandfather is a legitimate lay person. His father is a Gazlan. So just because his father inherited the property from his grandfather and he's a Gazlan, doesn't taint the property. And therefore the property is moving from the grandfather to the grandson, even though it's going derech or through the possession of his father who was a Gazlan, that doesn't take away from his claim. So therefore, a ben Gazlan can have a chazaka on property, as long as he's not making the claim that it's deriving from his father, but rather deriving from his grandfather. Because it's coming from a legitimate source, it's not tainted in any way, and his father being a Gazlan doesn't ruin it for him, and he can establish a chazak on it. So the Rashbam says, even though both are true, the girsa we have and the girsa that we just gave, he favors this girsa, and the Reish says that he thinks that this is the girsa. He's bothered by the fact that a ben beno shel Gazlan can establish a chazaka, because it should be fine, because his father was not a Gazlan, it was his grandfather that was a Gazlan. And the Reish says, why wouldn't we be toein on his behalf in that case? We would come in and say that he inherited it from his father. Who says it came from his grandfather? It might have come and his father might have bought it independently. Or even if his father stole it, the grandfather stole it, maybe his father went and bought it afterwards. So we would be toein on behalf of the Yoresh, because we always are toein on behalf of the Yoresh, Because the Yoresh doesn't know, but if there would have been a valid claim if his father was around, then we do it on his behalf. And we say, well, if he could prove that his father owned it for any amount of time, we will say that his father got it legitimately. And over here, there's no reason to believe that his father got it illegitimately because his father wasn't a gazlan. So he says, V'yesh yashev girsa rishona. Says, maybe we could explain the first girsa, which is what the Rashbam did, and say that the reason Pamim de ben ben agazlan enu chazaka is in a case where he declares that the property came through his grandfather. Because he's making a claim that his father told him that it came from his grandfather, and his grandfather was a gazlan. So that's the same way that the Rashbam explained it. That's what Tosfot does to defend it. But Tosfot is still plagued or bothered by the fact that why don't we toain for the Yoresh that his father did something to rectify it in the interim. I mean, that even though he says it came from my grandfather through my father, maybe his father went and bought it to clear up the name or clear up the property. And why aren't we toain on his behalf? So here he says something, Tosfot, that we've seen in the last two dapim. It says, Inami nirelari delotain and the Yoresh. Ki haigavna de milta de lo shchichahi. We are not toain on behalf of the Yoresh when it's something that is infrequent, something that is not so plausible. It's one thing to make a claim on behalf of a Yoresh when you're making a plausible claim. You say, I inherited it from my father, and we say that his father probably bought it from the other individual. He bought it from you. That's a plausible claim. To say that it came from my grandfather who was a gazlan, and my father said he got it from him, and now to make a claim that the father went after inheriting it from his father and purchased it from the mocher, that's a far-fetched scenario. We're not going to make a claim on his behalf. Again, we saw that the last 2 days in the daf with regards to the migo, that we don't say amigo in a situation where it's an implausible case. The Rashbam said it with regards to, if a person is toain that I returned it to you with Edim, but the Edim are now overseas, we don't believe that Tana, because he's afraid that those Edim will come back and undermine his testimony. So we're not going to say he could have had that alternate claim of saying I returned it with Edim and they're overseas, because that's not really a viable claim. It's not a plausible claim, because most people will not take that claim. It's too risky. And we saw that as well yesterday in the Balei Tosafot, when Edim spotted it with the individual, and he says, I bought it. So we should say, Migo, he really bought it, because he could have said, Lo yudvari molam, or I returned it to you. The Edim spotted it with him, even though they only had simanim and not tviyat ayin. That's enough of a reason for him to be scared to make that claim. He's too scared to make the claim that I returned it to you, or Lo yudvari molam, because he knows there are Edim out there that are saying that he has this object in possession. So then there, Tosfot said, it's too risky a claim. We don't say Migo. So that's the same thing over here. What we're suggesting here is that we're towing him the Yoresh when that's a reasonable claim. If it's not a reasonable claim, we're not going to make that claim on your behalf. Whether by Migo, we're not going to say that you have this alternate claim. Over here, we're not going to defend your position because the claim is not so plausible. It's not so frequent that that would happen. So again, if we're going to protect a claimant in court or a defendant in court, it has to be on the premise of something that would be plausible and reasonable and not unusual. And so that's what Balei Tosfot are saying in the end. That could help us out with this whole situation. The whole problem with the Re, with our Girsa, is the fact is, why aren't we protecting this grandson by saying that his father did something? The answer might be that the fact that his father did something when we know it came from his grandfather was a gazlan, that's already a far-fetched scenario, and therefore we would not be toain on behalf of the Yoresh. So now the Gemara asks the basic question, which is, what exactly is this gazlan that we are speaking about here? Hechi dami gazlan. What is exactly this scenario of gazlan? And Rabbi Yochanan, kigon, shuchuk zakal says, zo b'gazlanuta. There's already a chazaka, well-known information out there, that he took possession of this property as a gazlan. There's no question about it that everybody in town knows. It's a well-known piece of information that he stole this property, and that he's living on this property as a stolen piece of property. So that's one way that he could be established as a gazlan. Rav Chista Amar could go into Beit Ploni, Shehoragim Nefashot al Iske Mamon. Or, he derives from a family that are known as mafia, killers, and basically, if you don't acquiesce to their request, they kill you. So, in that case, you are easily compelled to do whatever they say, because it's your life that's at risk. Therefore, you can't establish a chazaka, because the reason that nobody's objecting is because you'll lose your life if you object. Of course, that's not considered to be an objection. So over here, you have two different ways to form or get a shame gazlan. And there is a nafkamina between them, as the Rashbam points out. The nafkamina between them is, where can you not establish a chazaka? If it is that you're deemed to be a gazlan because it's well known that you stole this property, or everybody knows that you're sitting on this property as a stolen property, you can't establish a chazak on that property because the way that it came into your possession was as a gazlan. On the other hand, on other properties, you should be totally fine to establish a chazak on because you're not a gazlan per se, you're a gazlan vis-a-vis this piece of property. On the other hand, with the person that comes from the family that compels people to do things or makes demands of them and kills them if they don't listen, over there they can never establish a chazakah whatsoever. Like we saw earlier in the Masechta with regards to the Reish Galuta. The Reish Galuta can't create a chazakah because nobody will object to the actions of the Reish Galuta. We have to have an ability to object. If you don't object when you have the ability to object, that's what establishes the chazakah. The lack of your objection shows or demonstrates that this person has ownership over here. Because you should have objected. The fact that you didn't is what drives the fact that he has a chazakah. If your lack of objection is not driven by the fact that you believe he's the owner, but rather because there's some other threat or problem here, that lack of objection is no longer a validation of his ownership. So by these individuals who are killers, you'll never object to anything they do because they will kill you. Given that, your lack of objection is no proof to their chazakah, and that's why they can never establish a chazakah. On the other hand, if a person is a gazlan for this particular piece of property, your lack of objection over here is because he's a gazlan. And whether he'll threaten your life, or we saw before, he'll threaten that he'll give it up to the authorities, whatever the reason is, you're not objecting here, not because you believe it's his property, either because it's well known he's a gazlan, so there's no reason for you to object, or your objection, even if it's registered, will do absolutely nothing. So therefore, you don't object. But on other properties, where he's not known as a gazlan, if you don't object, then you're basically acquiescing to his ownership. You're giving approval to his ownership. The Yerushbam makes a point in the end that there is no machloket over here. That these are not mutually exclusive positions. These both positions are true. Each one of them would agree to the other position. Rav Chista would agree that in the case where the property is known to be stolen, that other properties you could establish a chazakah. Rabbi Yochanan would agree that in a case where we're dealing with people who threaten people's lives, you can't establish a chazakah on any property. So Rabbi Yochanan says the case here is a case where it's not someone that takes your life over the money, but it's a well-known stolen property, and therefore you can't establish a chazakah. Whereas Rabbi Yochanan says the case we're speaking about here is a case of people who kill over monetary matters, and therefore you're too scared to say anything. So here, by them, the lack of objection is not a chazakah, because lack of objection is to protect your life. By Rabbi Yochanan, the lack of objection or the inability to create a chazakah is that it came into your possession. It's well known as a gazlan. Therefore, it doesn't really matter whether you object or not. Your possession of the property started on the wrong foot, which is that you stole it or it's well known that you stole it. And therefore, you can never establish a chazakah without proof to that fact. And even with proof, it might be difficult because we just saw before that a gazlan is not believed. Even if a person admits to a gazlan that he sold it to him, it's still not a good admission because we think it's under duress. And the rest of the daf today will deal with duress. And we're going to see that in most cases, we won't believe that the person really sold it or really gave it over to this person. Tana Banan. So now next case. Uman in lo chazaka. Unuman can't establish a chazaka. Again, once again, this is straightforward. That's our Mishnah. Aval yarad mi umanato yesh lo chazaka. If he retired from his profession or he went out of business, he can establish a chazaka. He basically becomes like any other layperson at that point in time. Aris ain't lo chazaka. Similarly with the sharecropper. Sharecropper himself cannot establish a chazaka if he's an aris beit avot. Yarad mi arisito. If he retired from being an aris, or he went into some other profession, yesh lo chazaka. Now he can establish chazaka through working on the property or working on the land. So, over here, the Balei Tosfot raised the question as to when the object came into his possession. So you could simply read it and say that it came into his possession after he retired. After he retired, he got the item, and he was a shoemaker. He retired from being a shoemaker, and now somebody gave him shoes. If he had shoes in his possession, that will establish a chazakah, because he shouldn't have this person's shoes. The fact that he has them is, possession is nine-tenths of the law. That's evidence of the fact that you must have bought them, and they're yours. He was a shoemaker in the past. That's irrelevant. He's not a shoemaker now. The same with the aris. The fact that he's working on this property now is evidence of the fact that it must be his property, because he's no longer an aris. And he came onto the property after he already retired from being an aris, after he retired from being a sharecropper. So that should establish his chazakah. That's what the Balei Tosafot suggests. Then they offer another alternative. The other alternative is that he was in his possession before he retired. He got the shoes while he was still a shoemaker. He got the property, but was still a sharecropper. After he retires, the property remains with him. After he retires, the shoes stay with him. He can establish a chazaka like that, the Baal Tosafot would say, because what are the shoes doing with him? He closed down the business. Why didn't the person come and get their shoes? Hey, no longer an aris. Why didn't the person say, give me my property back? The fact that the person didn't say something means that in retirement, he can establish a chazaka. The Tosafot gives one qualification of that. That is, if it's sufficient time for the person to come and pick it up. So if the person declares, I'm going into retirement today. So you can't establish chazaka going forward now. Oh, it's in my possession. It's mine. You have to have the requisite amount of time when people would normally pick up their items. When would the person who dropped off his shoes normally pick it up? Dry cleaning. When would you normally pick it up? If you leave it there for a long period of time, beyond the amount of time that normal people would leave it there, that's when you can establish the chazaka. Because then it's past the point of being connected to his profession, and now it's really part and parcel of his retirement or post going out of business, and that's why you can establish a chazaka. The Baal Tosafot go back now and say, you know what? Thinking about it, that must be true by the child as well. The child of the Uman and the child of the Aris can only establish a chazaka if they wait the requisite amount of time that it would no longer be classified as coming from the Uman or out of the possession of the Uman. That they can only make a claim of independent ownership. It's not clear in the Tosafot what exactly he's saying you need to wait, how much time you need to wait. Is it the amount of time that the son could have bought it himself? Or is it the amount of time that the Uman would normally get this out of his possession? So for instance, a shoemaker passes away. People had shoes with him when he passed away. Now all of a sudden the son says, well, it's in my possession, I can establish a chazaka. No, you can't, because you have to either have sufficient time to have bought them independently to give you a migo, or you need enough time for people to come and pick them up in the normal span of time. If they come and pick them up in the normal span of time, fine. Then you can establish a chazaka. Once it goes beyond that span of time, then you can establish a chazaka. So Tosafot goes back and applies it as well to the child of the craftsman, that the chazaka can only be established once you've passed that requisite amount of time. There has to be some buffer time in which it doesn't happen automatically on the day the person dies. Everybody's going to be outside the store taking their stuff back. That's not reasonable. They have to come within the normal period of time to take their stuff back, and the child will not have the ability to establish a chazaka. They will still be connected to their father in that case because of the fact that it came into their possession through the father. Okay, now the next two statements of that braita. Ben shechalak, a child that divided up property. Over here, the Rashbam explains the case as being a case where the child went independent. He was dependent on his father financially until now. Ben shechalak means that he went off and now became an independent individual. He got married. That's not always a guarantee that he's going to be independent, but he took on his own business. He's now earning money, and he is now independent of his father. Given that he has independence from his father, he can establish a chazaka on his father's property, or the father can establish on his son's property. We said before that a father and son cannot establish a chazaka on each other because of their relationship. What the Gemara is qualifying, or the Braita is qualifying over here, that's only true when the relationship is a relationship of dependence. If they are now independent, financially independent, then the child can establish a chazaka on the father on the child, because we no longer say that they might be mochel on each other. That's not so easy to say, because there are many times that you would believe that the father-child relationship extends beyond the fact that they are monetarily independent. Now then, the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom over here explains it is, Shenatano aviv chelko b'chayav. Father distributed the inheritance in his lifetime. So he already distributed to the child and all the, here, the different children, their inheritance. At that point, then the son's establishment of a chazaka is cleared from his father, because now he has nothing to do with his father. His father gave all of his property away. He already divided up his property to his son. In that case, any interaction between them afterwards would establish a chazaka. Or you could say that it's the other children, his brothers and sisters. If he sits on all the property after his father's distributed the property and they don't object, then he can establish a chazaka versus his siblings because they didn't come and claim their property. And afterwards he can say, you sold it to me, and or you gave it to me. And he has a valid claim because they didn't stop him from staying there. And that would be the simplest way to explain it, even though both the Rabbeinu Gershom and the Rashbam do not say this. The easy way to explain it is Ben Shechalak is a case of Yerusha. It's a case where the siblings divided up the property. The father passed away. They're dividing up the property. And now the siblings don't object to him sitting on more property than his share. He took a bigger share than he was supposed to, and nobody says anything about it. Over there, you might think that it's mechila because it's the estate, and they just say, you know, he's in the estate, he'll give it to us later. Now, Gemara says, no, he's able to establish a chazakah in this case because I bought it from my brother, I bought it from my sister. They can't block that claim. You should have taken your property or declared it your property. The fact that you didn't, you lost your rights. Visha shenit garsha, and a woman who is divorced, harein kishar kol adam, both the ben shechalak, or the isha shenit garsha, as well as all the other people we saw in this braita, all of them have a din like a layperson. So the hardest part here is the isha shenit garsha, which is what the Gemara is going to ask about in a second. So here when they're divorced, the husband can now establish a chazakah on his wife, a wife on the husband. Because we said before that husband and wife don't have the ability to establish a chazakah because they're mochel on each other. The nature of their relationship is that they can't establish a chazakah on each other. Gemara asks, Bishlama ben shechalak, when you're talking about a son that divided up, again, the three different interpretations that we gave, itzrich. There you would need it. You would have thought that he still forgives it. Kamash malan, dolo. Ella isha shenit kasha, pshita. What do you mean? A woman that got divorced, that's pshita. The key difference is that a woman who's divorced from her husband completely severs the relationship. There is no other relationship. Yes, it's his ex-wife, ex-husband, but there is no relationship that is residual to that. A father and son, there is always a residual relationship, even with siblings. Even if they're financially independent or their properties were split, they still have a relationship as siblings or as a father and son. So you could argue that that relationship supersedes their financial independence, and therefore you would be mochel, and you can't establish a chazakah that way because people aren't makpid. The chiddush of the braita is, no, you can't establish a chazakah. But by a woman who's divorced from her husband, why can't the wife, ex-wife and ex-husband establish a chazakah on each other? They are now complete strangers to each other. They have zero relationship, and the Rashbam goes out of his way to say it's just the opposite. Their relationship is one of acrimony. They got divorced, they bas sonim zedzeh. So it'd even be more evidence, the fact that you have the husband's property, the husband has your property, that'd be even more evidence to the fact that you establish a chazakah, because they would never let you stay there. They're not going to give you the right to stay on the property. So, lo, tzricha, you need a case, bimigureshet, venu migureshet. It's a situation in which they are not completely divorced. The case here are cases not relevant to our Gemara, but in Gittin, the Gemara there has, and the Mishnayot there have, case after case, where there's a Safek Yerushin. Classic one is that he threw the get to her, and Safek Karuv Lo, Safek Karuv La. So Safek, whether it was closer to him or closer to her, and now you have Safek Yerushin. You have a situation in which the get was given, but there's a Safek as to the validity of the get. So she is divorced, but not divorced. And that has implications halachically. And one of them is, Kukud Rabbi Zeira. Dama Rabbi Zeira, Amar Rabbi Yirmiya, Ba'aba, Amar Shmuel, Kol Mankom Shemuch Chachamim, Megureshet, Veinu Megureshet. Anytime the Chachamim say there's a safek in the Gerushin, then Bala Chayav B'Mizonotah. The husband is still Chayav to provide her with Mizonot, because as the Rashbam points out, Akati Agidi Be, she's stuck. The fact that she's stuck obligates the husband to provide her Mizonot. Since she doesn't have the ability to be independent, find herself a new husband, find herself a new protector, do something on her own because of the lack of clear gerushin, therefore we obligate the husband to feed her and give her mizonot. And if you remember before, the reason that a wife can't establish a chazakah on her husband is because of the mizonot. Husband is compelled to provide his wife mizonot under the contract of the ketubah, under his obligations as a husband. So his wife might be in the field, because the husband's obligated to pay her mizonot, and that's his way of providing for his wife. He lets her work this field. He lets her take the produce from this field. That's her mizonot. So you can't establish a chazakah in that way, because we never know if she's doing it because she owns it. She's doing it because of mizonot. So here, where he's still chayav in mizonot, that issue would still apply. Now, Bali Tosafot over here qualify that and say, ukugon sheichada ara achrito. It's only in a case where he designated her another a piece of property. So what the Bali Tosafot basically can say is continuing what we said before, that mizonot basically block her ability to establish a chazakah, because we'll always assume that all the property that she's in is the husband being generous and letting her get her mizonot from the property. So she cannot establish on any properties. So what the Bali Tosafot say is, if the husband hasn't designated a property for her here to take her mizonot, then we're in the same situation as when she's married. He's chayav in her mizonot. We can't assume that any property she's in is a chazakah because it could be for her mizonot. The Braita said she can establish a chazakah. Why? So Tosfot says, kigon yichadla arali the mizonotah. He designated a specific property for her to get her mizonot from. That means on any other piece of property, she could establish a chazaka. Because she has a particular property designated for him as zonot. Every other property now is not for him as zonot, and therefore she could establish a chazaka over there.
Yes.
So now, the truth is, nobody says this explicitly, but the Tosafot's reasoning should apply even to a married couple. Which is that if he already gives her a mizonot through a particular property, then why can't she establish chazaka on other properties if the whole reason she can't establish a chazaka is because of mizonot? So you could argue maybe by the married couple there are other things besides mizonot that he's forgiving her, he lets her do more than she's entitled to, but over here he's not going to do that. The Rishbam disagrees with the Bayit Tosafot and said that's not the case here at all. Because over here we would not assume that the mizonot block her ability to get a chazaka, because over here the husband is not giving the mizonot willingly. He is not giving mizonot in this case because he wants to. He tried to divorce his wife. It failed because of some technicality in the halacha. So now we're going to obligate him to give mizonot. If he's going to give mizonot over here, the Rishbam repeats again, sonim zetzeh. They're in a place of already acrimony, hatred between the parties. And again, in their day, if the divorce was going through or he was actually divorcing his wife, it had to be pretty extreme because it was much less common than today. Divorce today, you could have couples that separate and it's still on speaking terms or on good terms afterwards. In their day, if it got to the point of divorce, which was so uncommon, then it must have been that there was acrimony or there was difficulty in this situation. Given that, the husband's not going to give mizonot to this woman willingly. He's going to give it bitzimtzum. He's going to give the exact amount. And only after the courts tell me he has to give the mizonot. Given that, you can't say that the mizonot are blocking her ability to establish a chazaka. That's why she can establish a chazaka over here. Because there's no way she's on this property collecting her mizonot like a queen. He's not going to treat her like a queen. He's going to make her beg for every penny that she needs to get in mizonot. And he's not going to allow her free reign over a piece of property to get her mizonot. Given that, that's why you can establish a chazaka over here. Because it's completely different than the mizonot in a marriage. Zonot in a marriage is something that he wants to do. He wants to provide his wife, and he's going to be generous about it. These mizonot are being compelled, or being forced upon him, and therefore she can establish a chazaka, because the husband's no way he's going to let her sit in a property, even if he owes her a mizonot. All right, so now, Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Li Huna. Nachman says, Rav Huna said to me, Kulan Sheheviu. The Kulan over here, it's not clear who the Kulan are. The way that the Rishbam writes it is Uman Varis. All those people that we have the list of individuals who we say that they don't have a chazakah, he mentions Uman Aris, it seems to be that he is cross-referencing the Mishnah. On the other hand, the Balei Tosafot over here suggests that the Kulan includes even the people that we just talked about, the Migureshet, Ben and the Aviv, it even includes them. Kulan, all of these individuals, it's more expansive. Not saying that the Rishbam necessarily doesn't agree to that, but the Rishbam quotes specifically the people that were mentioned in the Mishnah, not the people mentioned in the Braita. On the other hand, the Balei Tosafot seem to include even the people mentioned in the Braita. Kulan sheviu raya, rayatan raya, umamidin sadeh biyadan. All these individuals who are precluded from establishing a chazakah, if they show up with evidence that they bought it, that evidence is fine. We will allow them to say that it's theirs and that they purchased it. If you have a shtar that says you purchased the property, you have a deem that it was sold to you, that's fine. Because chazaka was being utilized to replace the need for that evidence, to replace the need for the shtar. But if you have the shtar, if you have the evidence of the fact of the kinyan, then you can own the property, because you're not using chazaka anymore. All these people are precluded is because they can't establish a chazaka because of the nature of their relationship, or their profession, whatever it is, they can't establish a chazaka. That's all because they want to establish a chazaka. If you could establish ownership without a chazaka, that'd be fine. So that's what it means. So their raytan raya, their proof is a good proof. Umamidin sadebi adam. And we leave the property with them. Bayit Tosafot say, what do you mean we leave the property with them? Of course you leave the property with them. If they have proof, then it's their property. So in the end, the Bayit Tosafot basically claimed that this first part of the statement of Rav Nachman is not a chiddush whatsoever. There is no chiddush in this statement. The point is that if they bring proof, we believe it. The big chiddush is in the second part. Gazlan shevi raya. On the other hand, a thief that comes along and brings proof to ownership, ein rayato raya. First of all, his proof is no proof. Number two is, ve'im amidin sadeh biyado. We don't leave the field with him. We return the field to the original owners. So that means that there are actually two things that are happening here, and that's what the Balei Tosafot point out. that number one, he doesn't get to keep the field, even though he has edim that the original owner admitted to selling it to the gazlan. So over there, you would think that the gazlan should be able to keep it. He has evidence for the fact that he bought it from this individual. We say, no, evidence is not considered to be evidence over here. Give the field back. But then, even the seller, when he admitted, said that I sold it to him, which means that the gazlan paid him money for the field, or presumably paid him money for the field. That's what we say, that only the Sadeh returns, and he doesn't get his money back. So he's going to lose on both fronts. Gazlan, we're going to force him to disgorge the property, because we don't believe his proof. And number two is, we're not going to make him return the money to the original owner. That's probably because we believe he never did pay the money. But even if he did pay the money, there's a knas, and he won't get his money back. So therefore, the chiddush, it's a huge chiddush, is that a gazlan cannot establish ownership over property through evidence, and that fact now puts him at risk that if we can bring him to court and adjudicate the case, we're going to force him to disgorge the property, and we're not going to force the original owner to give him any money back. We're going to dissolve the entire sale or supposed sale over here. Maika Mashmalan, what is Rav Nachman's statement here in the name of Rav Huna teaching us? Tanina, it's an explicit Mishnah back in Gitin. Lakach mi sikrikon. He bought it from the sikrikon. V'chazar lakach mi balabait. And then he went again and purchased it from the original owner. Mekho batel. The transaction fails. So this is a Mishnah in Gitin. The sikrikon, the Gemara over there goes through, and the Rashbam quotes it over here. It's not necessarily important to our Gemara, that there were different stages along the way where the Roman army, after the Merit Agadol, was in Israel. And these infantrymen, or these individuals who were part of the army, after the battles were over, they basically went ahead and plundered the property of the Jews that were there. That plundering is problematic because they obviously were not paying for the property. They were taking the property. Why they were taking the property, and there were, that's what the Rashbam and the Gemara Gittin discussed, there were different stages. There were stages where they were compelled to take property because basically the rule of the army was that if you didn't steal from a Jew, if you didn't throw them off their property, you'd be killed. Or if you had to kill a Jew, I mean, that there were all these different rules. In the end, when it got down to the bottom line, it became illegal. But nevertheless, there were still these ex-army individuals running around taking Jews' property and forcing them or compelling them to give up their property. So now, when a Jew gives up the property, do we assume that he's really giving up with a full heart? So that depends on what the threat to his life is. And that's what the Gemara says in the end, that he wasn't at threat of life or limb. And so when he gives up the property, he's not really giving up because he wants to. He's being compelled by this individual to give it up. These sikrikon had no interest in living there. They weren't staying here. They weren't going to live there. The way that they were going to make their money was by selling it to someone else. I got it for free. I sell it to someone else. So what they did was they sold it to a Jew. Another Jew goes ahead and buys it from the sikrikon. What the Mishnah says is, the purchase from the sikrikon fails because the sikrikon doesn't have a valid claim to the property. You're buying from someone who doesn't have a claim. So what does the individual do? He goes back to the original owner and says, I want to buy it from you. I'm going to purchase it from you. Now that I bought it from you, that will validate my claim to the property. The Mishnah says, mechol batel, it doesn't work. Even when you go and buy it from the original owner, it doesn't work. The Rashbam clarifies over here, even though many of the Rishonim don't necessarily agree with the Rashbam's perspective, only because we're in the Havamina of the Gemara now. The Havamina of the Gemara doesn't have this distinction. The Gemara in the conclusion will make this distinction, but the Rashbam assumes it already in the beginning of the Gemara, that this situation is a case where there was no money that exchanged hands. That means that the sikrikon, when he took it from this individual, never paid it from him. Confiscated the property, took it, plundered the property. Then he sold it for cash to this other Jew. The other Jew comes to the original owner and says, write me a contract that it's really sold to me. He doesn't pay him money. He simply wants a contract corroborating that it's really his, that he really owns the property, and the guy writes a contract for him. We say over there, mechol batel. It doesn't work. So he comes around, but he sold it to this Jew. Now he goes to the original owner, give me a document. The guy says, yeah, I don't want to give you a document. The second one says, what do you mean you don't want to give him a document? So that's a Mishnah in Gittin. And basically what the Mishnah in Gittin says is, even if you come with valid paperwork that shows that you own it, it doesn't work. Your raya is not a raya. So I already have that from the Mishnah in Gittin. What do I need Rav Nachman to tell me that a shtar or a documentation or raya doesn't work over here? That's already explicit in the Mishnah in Gittin. Again, we bumped into sikrikon and Gittin again in Baba Kamma. The word sikrikon likely comes from the word sikari. The Sikari were also known as a sect during the time of the Churban HaBayit. They were a violent sect that did not want to surrender at all to the Romans and wanted to fight to the death. And over there, it was a negative Right, the Sikari, which were, it was a very negative term. I mean, that it was associated with quote-unquote zealots, but people who were unwilling to compromise or surrender. Although the secret code numbers being met here are not the same people, but it's the same idea, which is that these are people who quote-unquote live by the sword, and that their whole mechanism of communication is the sword. So if you communicate by the sword, so whether you're Jew or non-Jew, the secret code of this word Sikari applies to you. Again, here it's not referencing those people that were at the time the zealots or the, maybe possibly the people on Masada, the time of the Churban HaBayit, but rather here we're talking about the Roman army that is in Judea at the time, that Roman army, after they finish the battles, take up plundering the Jewish properties and enjoying themselves. So now, given that, what is Rav Nachman's Chiddush? So Gemara says, Lafukei Midei Rav. It's coming to deny the position of Rav. Dama Rav. This is Rav's position qualifying the Mishnah and Gittin. Lo shanu adamar leilek chazek ukne. It's only in a case where the original owner says to the Jew who bought it off the secret cone, yeah, go ahead, take it. It's all yours. Go ahead, take possession of it. If he says that, we don't believe him, because the only reason he's doing that is because he's afraid of the secret cone. Aval bishtar, if he writes a document, kana. Then he is koneh, because Rav believes if you already went that far to write out a document, you're not compelled to write a contract. The fact that you wrote a contract, that's already a voluntary action, and therefore it is binding. The contract is binding. Kamash Malon, Rav Nachman is teaching us Kiddush Shmuel, that the din is like Shmuel. Rav Nachman is a Talmud of Shmuel, and Rav Nachman and Rav Huna is basically saying that the din is like Shmuel, the Amar, Af Bishtar Lo Kana. Even with the Shtar, that's not an evidence to get you the Kinyan. Unless you write a shtar, then you have recourse back to this individual. Now, it's one thing to write a shtar because you're afraid of the secret cone. So you write a shtar to corroborate the ownership over here so the secret cone can go through with the sale and the guy pays him the money. On the other hand, to write a shtar that says you have recourse against the original owner, why would he write recourse into the shtar? He doesn't have any obligation to this buyer over here, and the secret cone himself doesn't care about recourse because he got the property for free. Recourse is only important when you paid money for a property and you're afraid that someone's going to confiscate the property and you're going to lose the property and your money. Secret cone here got the property for free, sold it, is making money. He has a zero basis in the property, made money. What does he care if the property gets confiscated afterwards? Nobody's coming back to him to demand their money back. And so therefore recourse is not a part and parcel of this sale. If the then original owner, the Jew who had the property taken away from him by the secret cone, goes in and writes a contract with achrayut to the Jew who purchased it from the secret cone, saying, yeah, you know what, if that property gets taken away from me, you can come back and make a claim against me, recourse against me. No way would you write that in the contract. No way the secret cone would demand it. Given that, it's considered to be a binding sale, or that is evidence. So here is the way that a gazlan can overcome his problem as a gazlan, is to have a shtar with achrayut in it, because then that's going too far. I mean, that if already you're being compelled to write a shtar in a manner that has recourse or is beyond what would be demanded in these cases, then already you have evidence that it's probably yours. Now, in the case of secret cone, achrayut would work. If it's directly with interacting with the gazlan, maybe even with achrayut, it wouldn't work because the gazlan is compelling you to sell it to him. And he wants the full weight of the law, and he wants a contract that has recourse in it. So because of that, Shmuel says, but that's the case where we believe him. Otherwise, we won't believe him. So that's what Rav Nachman is coming to say, that the explanation of the Mishnah is like Shmuel, that even a shtar is not enough evidence. Rabbi Misayim Be Mishmei de Rav Nachman. Rabbi added on in Rav Nachman himself saying, which means that Rav Nachman here said it in the name of Rav Huna, and then Rabbi says Rav Nachman went on to add something of his own, which is this: Karka Ein Lo, Ava Ma'ot Yesh Lo. He does not have a right to the property, but he does have a right to get his money back. The gazlan brings a proof. His proof is invalid. So we said before in Rav Huna's statement, his proof is invalid to the point where, number one, he has to disgorge the property. And number two is he's not going to get his money back, even if there's a claim that money changed hands. What Rav Nachman says is, I don't think that's right. Rav Nachman says, Karka Ein Lo, he has to disgorge the property because his proof is not a proof. Aval Ma'ot Yesh Lo. The original owner has to return the money to the gazlan, which means that money changed hands over here. Bamed Devarim Amorim, when's that true? Shamru Eidim Bifaneinu Manalo. That in front of us, he counted out the money. If the Edim witnessed that there was a sale here, meaning that the gazlan compelled the owner to sell him the property, and the owner takes the cash, the gazlan takes the property. Now the gazlan says, I have evidence of the fact that there was a transaction over here. We say your evidence is completely invalid because you are a gazlan. So we're going to force him to give the property back to the original owner. But when we force him to give the property back to the original owner will also have to return the money because we have edim that the transaction went down. Amru edim bifanenu hodelo. If the edim say that in front of us he admitted that he received money for the property, lo. In that case, we would not compel him to give the money back. Kid Rav Kahana. This is Rav Kahana again. Dama Rav Kahana. Rav Kahana says, Ilav Dodile, Avamati Lady Day, Luchamre, Lushachvar. Again, because the person was forced and compelled to say certain things or act in a certain way because of the pressure or the blackmail that the Gazlan was using. The Gazlan basically said to him, either you give me the property or I'm going to turn it over to the authorities or I'm going to have it confiscated by the authorities. So in the same vein, the edim who hear him say, yeah, yeah, I sold it to you. Yeah, yeah, I got money and I sold it to you. Why is he saying that? He's saying that because the Gazlan compelled him to do that. Then the edim who are witnessing this have no idea what they're witnessing. Yes, they witnessed the sale. But the same way that the sale was done under duress in the first place, so too is his admission of the sale is also done under duress. And therefore the edim, yes, they're testifying truthfully, but their testimony doesn't give us evidence of the fact that he really purchase the property. On the other hand, if the edim witness cash changing hands, edim are not going to lie because this guy's lying forced them to lie and say, yeah, yeah, he paid him money. Because the edim in general are going to tell the truth, but they will tell the truth, but not know the context of the truth. So in the case where they have an admission that the original owner sold it to the gazlan, they'll come and tell the truth that they saw an admission. We intuitively understand that the admission was done under duress. So even though the edim are telling the truth, the admission was under duress. The other hand, they didn't come to court and tell us that money changed hands. They saw the gazlan paying the mocher, the original owner. Over there, the edim are not going to come to lie in court when it's not to their benefit, when it's not something that's going to benefit them directly. So they're going to tell the truth. If they tell us money changed hands, we're going to believe then that money changed hands. Given that, if we unwind the sale, we're also going to force them to give the money back. We're giving him his property back. He's also have to give the money back. What the Rashbam points out, and the Gemara will say it in 1 second, is what Rabibi is saying is that it's Rav Nachman's position. That means, or implicit in that, and that's what the Rashbam says, is that Rav Huna disagrees with that. So Rav Huna's position is based on the next piece of the Gemara. Rav Huna's position says that a sale under duress is considered to be a valid sale. Given that, then if money changed hands, the sale was valid. From here we understand that Rabibi's position is, if they compel him or they put him under duress and he makes a sale, that sale is not a proper sale. Given the fact that it's not a proper sale, that's why he says, first of all, the raya, the proof is obviously no proof. And even if we know that money exchanged hands over here, we will still return the money because the sale is not successful. The implications of that are, as far as Rav Huna is concerned, then if money exchanged hands, and we have evidence of the fact that the money exchanged hands, the transaction is considered to be complete and done. And therefore, there would be no unwinding of the transaction. The money would remain and the land would remain. The statement of Rav Nachman, the name of Rav Huna before, was premised on the idea that there was no evidence of ma'ot exchanging hands over here. And that's why we say, number one, the ra'aya is not a valid ra'aya, because we assume that it was compelled or done under duress. But you also don't allow for the money to be returned. Because if there was money, then we would say the transaction went through and it would be a complete transaction. So given the fact that we are saying that the transaction is invalid and we're returning the land, by definition, then we don't have to return the money. Therefore, we'll disgorge the property, but we will not force the original owner to give the money back, either as a knas, or we don't believe that the money changed hands. Because if there was money, then the transaction would be fine because of Rav Huna's position coming up, which is that if they compelled him or put him under duress and he made a sale, that sale is a valid sale. And therefore, as long as money changed hands, it is considered to be a valid sale. Because he believes a sale under duress is classified as a sale. So that's the way the Rashbam posits the machloket here between Rav Bibi in the name of Rav Nachman versus Rav Nachman in the name of Rav Huna. Rav Nachman believes a sale under duress is not considered a sale. Rav Huna believes that sale under duress is considered a sale, and therefore they would come to these differing conclusions. Balei Tosafot over here say, Tzad kasho halashon. Tosafot says, the language of Rav Bibi says, Misayim, Bei, Mishmei the Rav Nachman, is a little bit problematic. Taha Rav Bibi polik. Rav Bibi here is clearly arguing on the position of Rav Huna. Based on what we just explained now, Rav Nachman's extension of Rav Huna's position makes that Rav Nachman argues on Rav Huna. So then why before do we quote, I'm Rav Nachman, I'm Rav Huna, which is that Rav Nachman's quoting Rav Huna as if this is a memra, and then Rav Bibi comes on and says, oh, Rav Nachman's position is this. That means that basically Rav Nachman argues on Rav Huna. Where is that language over here? We don't find that anywhere in the Gemara indicating that this is a machloket Rav Nachman Rav Huna. So Bayit Tosafot just point that out, that that's a little bit of a problem here, that the language doesn't seem to indicate that there was an argument between them. So now we move on to the next piece. I'm Rav Huna. Tell you, Bizavin, Zvine, Zvine. If they hung him up, they strung him up on a tree, and they told him, if you don't sell it, we're going to leave you hanging here on the tree. We're going to beat you up if you don't sell it. The sale is a valid sale. My time. What's the reason behind that? Called him Zaminish. Ilav Danis. Loavim Mizavin. People don't sell their possessions willingly. People sell their possessions only under duress. We saw this on the Rashbam, actually on last week's daf. Last Friday on Mem Amud Bet, we actually saw this in the Rashbam. The Rashbam, when he was speaking about a moda'ah, a case where a person says, I was compelled, it was under duress that I sold it. Over there we said the edim must know what the duress is. Because if the guy just claims general duress when he sold it, and that's his moda'ah, it doesn't work. It says the Rashbam quoted over here, T'iklam Eymar stam mocher lo birtzono mocher. A stam mocher doesn't sell willingly. Ela mishum chisaron ma'ot. It's only because he lacks liquidity or he needs cash. So he's selling under duress because he needs the cash. That duress is not enough to consider it. That duress does not invalidate the sale. And that's exactly what's going on over here. The Gemara is saying that even though people sell under duress, because otherwise they wouldn't sell their property, they wouldn't sell their possessions, the only reason they're selling them is because they need cash. That means they're selling under duress. And we don't say that the transaction is invalid. So just like over there, we don't say the transaction is invalid. So to over here, when he was compelled, we don't say that the transaction is invalid. Now, the Rashbam points this out. It's a clear question over here. What do you mean? There are different types of sales. Not everybody sells under duress. Some people, like merchants, sell willingly. So how do you know that every sale is under duress? What the Rashbam points out is that even though there are some sales that are not under duress, some sales that are under duress, we make no differentiation. And we say all sales are valid sales. So whether you needed cash or you didn't need cash, we say the sale is valid. Given that, it shows you that we don't see duress as a reason to unwind or undermine a sale. That shows you that duress is not a valid argument in a sale. And therefore, no matter what the duress is, whether it's duress from liquidity or need for cash, whether it's duress being imposed upon you by other people, when there is a sale, it is a valid sale. Again here, the Rashbam points out a distinction that the Gemara will make in the end, which is that that's only true if the sale went through with cash. That means that you were paid money for the item. If you were under duress, you gave it as a matana, you gave it as a gift, that is not valid. Assuming that it's proper remuneration over here for the field, if cash exchanged hands, no matter what the duress was, the sale is a valid sale. Because in the end, he got his compensation, he got the money, he might not have wanted to sell. Just like a person who's desperate for cash doesn't want to sell, but he needs the cash. So it's over here. You didn't want to sell, but you got the value in the end. You got the cash that you would have been entitled to. And therefore, we say the sale is valid. By matana, where you're giving it for free, and you're unilaterally giving something over, that is not does not work under duress. Because over there, you can't say that even though there's duress, he really wants to give the gift. I mean, he doesn't want to, he gives a gift. A gift, by definition, is something that's voluntary. It's never involuntary, the gift. And if it is involuntary, it's done under duress, there's a problem. So that's the distinction that the Rashbam points out, which is the conclusion of the Gemara. Again, many Rishonim think that that's not the case yet, that the Gemara is yet to acknowledge that difference. Because that will have nafkaminot in the successive Gemara over here, which is, basically what the Gemara wants to know is, what is the source for Rav Huna's position? So the Gemara suggests over here that when somebody sells under duress, when he needs cash, we say the sale is valid. So why should this duress be different? A very easy distinction. It makes a difference whether the duress is coming internally, meaning that you're doing it because you realize you have no choice and you want to do it, versus an imposed duress, which is coming from the outside. It's one thing that when you're under pressure for cash and you make the decision that this is your best option at this point in time, then that's one type of duress. It's different when someone is hitting you and saying, sell the property, and you don't want to be hit anymore, so you sell the property. That's imposed duress. And one could see an easy distinction between a duress that is self-imposed in a sense, because you're in a bind of your own making likely, that duress compels you to do something, you might be willing to do it in the end. But where the action is completely involuntary, the action is being compelled by the duress imposed by others, maybe you would not say it's the same thing. So we can distinguish between the cases, and that's not a good proof to the fact that sales under duress are a good sale. But it says, Ella Kedetanya. It comes from the following Braita. It's a very famous Braita. Yakriv Oto. Melameid Shekofin Oto. It says when it speaks about bringing the Kurban Ola, it says Yakriv Oto, that he is compelled to bring it and to bring the Akrava. We say that we force him, we compel him to bring the Kurban. It says, Yachol Baal Korcho. You would think that you compel him against his will. Tamalomar Lirtsono. The Pasuk says he has to bring the Kurban willingly. So how can you compel him if he has to bring the Kurban willingly? Haketzad, how do we resolve this seeming contradiction? Kofin Oto, Achiumer Rotzani. We beat him up, we hit him until he says, yeah, I want to do it. So again, let's move on in the Gemara a little bit, and then we'll come back to try to understand it. It says, Badilma Shani Hotam, maybe the case where Kurban is different, then Nechale Davile Kapara. He wants Kapara, he wants atonement. And therefore, even though the duress is imposed from the outside, there is another factor that would compel him to agree to that. And that is the fact that he gains kapara over here. The Bala Teo Tosafot raises a serious issue over here, which is the fact that the Gemara in Bava Kamma already told us that Eimim Ashkenin ala kaparot, that we don't take a mashkon to compel a person to bring a korban that is for kapara. And that means that by chataot and ashamot, if a person has to bring those korbanot, we're not going to take a mashkon to compel him to bring the Kurban, because he's self-motivated to bring it. He wants atonement for the sin. That self-motivation will compel him to bring the Kurban, and therefore we don't have to induce outside pressure for him to bring the Kurban. But that's only true by Chataot Vashamot. That's not true by Nola. Onola is a Nidava or a Neder. It is a voluntary offering. It is something that he took upon himself, but was not compelled to do. So what are you saying over here that maybe the reason that the kofin works over here is because it's kapara? That's the whole distinction the Gemara made in Baba Kamma, is that chatot vashamot are for kapara. You don't need a mashkon. Unola is not for kapara, and therefore you do need a mashkon. What do you mean? Over here you're saying that kapara, that unola does have kapara. So what we have here is a stira between the Gemarot as how to view unola. Is unola a mechanism for kapara? Or is unola doron, a gift? And therefore, there is no compelling or self-motivating reason for you to bring the Ola. So the answer that the Balei HaTosafot will bring is that the kapara mentioned in the Gemara here is Hanu Mashe Nadar, that he discharges his obligation vis-a-vis the Neder, Shim Lo Yishalem Nidro Avono Isa. Because if he doesn't discharge the obligation versus his Neder, he will in the future be burdened with an avon, that he will have to then deal with avono isa, the punishment or the repercussions of not bringing the korban. So the bringing of the korban is not necessarily inherently a kapara, but it's protective in the sense that it gives you kapara in protecting you from the possible ramifications of not bringing this korban in the future. Now, as far as the kapara aspects of the ola, an ola really sits on the edge. An ola inherently is not a korban kapara. It's a korban doron. It's a gift to God. It happens to be that riding on top of it, or as an added bonus, a person who brings an ola gets kapara from mitzvot asay, or lavan itakli asay, other things that are mentioned in the Gemara, as to what an ola is mechaper for. So what the Balei Tosafot say is that the primary motivation or reason for a korban ola is not for its kapara, but rather for its act as a voluntary offering. For that reason, a person is not going to feel motivated to bring the korban, and that's why we would take a mashkon from him to compel him to bring the korban. Because the kapara is just something that comes, mikufya, something that floats on top. It's an additional benefit, but it's not the primary purpose of the ola. The Ramban says the same thing, but basically says that's why over here, by the neder nedava, when we compel him to do it, and beat him up, he says, Rotze ani, because he will get that kapara. In the end, that kapara, even though it's not the primary purpose, but it is something that is a derivative of the korban, and that makes it so that he is willing to bring the korban, or willing to say, Rotze ani. The Gemara says, okay, Given that that can't be the proof to Rav Huna's position, Elami Seifa, maybe it's for the latter half of that Mishnah. Also by a divorce. By a divorce, it says, an individual who is obligated to give a get, that's how the Rashbam explains it, it's clear in Halacha that we're passing this way, that if a person is obligated to give a get, and he refuses to give the get, he can't be compelled to give the get. We force him until he says, I will give the get. So in that case, again, we have outside duress that's causing him to willingly, quote-unquote, give the get. And we see that as being a valid get. So maybe that's the proof here, too, by the sale. That the sale under duress is considered to be a sale. It says, V'dilmei shani hatam. Maybe it's different over there. The mitzvah d'shmoa divrei chachamim. The reason that he wants to do it over there is because he wants to listen to the chachamim. The chachamim say you must give a get. In the end, the reason he does it, or we consider him to be doing it willingly, is because he wants to do what the chachamim say. That's actually what the Gemara says with regards to arayot. In the Mishnah, there are certain arayot that are restricted because of isur kedusha, and other ones that are asur mishum isur mitzvah. The Gemara goes, what's the difference between them? It says that isur mitzvah are shniot arayot. Those are arayot midrabanan. Isur kedusha are arayot that derive from the fact like a kohen is not allowed to marry a divorcee. A kohen gadol cannot marry an almana. Those are isur kedusha. So the Gemara over there says, what do you mean? Why are shniot arayot considered to be a isur mitzvah? Gemara answers, because mitzvah d'shmoa l'divrei chachamim. They're called isur mitzvah because the mitzvah is to listen to the chachamim. So similarly over here, there's a mitzvah to listen to the chachamim, and that's why it's considered to be a valid get, but not because duress is something that can compel a person to reach a point of willingness. Where it says, ela svarahu. The answer in the end, it's all logical. Rav Huna cannot bring a proof from a person selling under duress for money, because that's the individual himself, not outside duress. Can't bring a proof from korban, because the korban is associated with kapara. Can't bring a proof from gitei nashim, because over there you have a mitzvah lishma divrei chachamim. So there's another factor that would compel you to agree to do it. So over here, what is the reason that you, under duress, it's considered to be a sale? It's a svara, a logical argument. A gabunse, gamar amakne. From the duress, in the end, he finally agrees. He agrees or acquiesces. The fact that he received compensation and gets his full payment for the property, in the end, he's willing to sell it in order to escape the duress. And yes, the duress is what compelled him, but in the end, he really decides and says, you know what, I really do want to sell it. And that he really does cross that line and say that I actually do want to sell it. And it's not that it's all done under duress and unwillingly, but rather it's done willingly in this case. So now here there are a number of issues that we have to address. The Gemara's assumption here is that if something that's done under duress is considered to be valid because of two things. One is that the person in the end says, Rotzani, that I willingly would do it. And number two is that there was consideration. There was cash paid. We know that because the Gemara says by a matana, it does not work. By a gift, it doesn't work. Because by a gift, you have the rotzani, don't have the consideration. So what the Balei Tosfot ask is, what are you going to do about the korban and the get isha? By the korban and the get isha, you have the rotzani, you don't have the consideration to make it that it is willing. If that's the case, when the Gemara proposes learning it out from a korban, or learning it out from a get nashim, the conclusion would be that duress would be good for a mecher, and even for a matana. It would seem that even a matana would work under duress. So how could these be proofs? Because these lack consideration. And despite the lack of consideration, then we say they go through. The Balei Tosfot here give two answers. One answer is that there is consideration over here. Even in the case of a korban, there's consideration. And even in the case of a gitei nashim, there is consideration. And he says the following. The consideration by a korban is kone kapara. He gets kapara. He gets the kapara from bringing the korban. That is his consideration. He brings the korban, and as a benefit of bringing the korban, the consideration is that he got kapara. So therefore, you have duress and consideration. And therefore, this paradigm would only include mecher and not matana. By gitei nashim, the divorce frees him his obligations to pay sher ksut ve'ona. He's now released from having to pay the obligations he has towards his wife. So now you have rotzani. And you have consideration. Consideration is being freed of these obligations. So there is consideration here. That's the one way the Balei Tosfot deal with it. The other way the Balei Tosfot deal with it is to say, lasot, mecher. Anything that you are obligated to do, That obligation, or the discharging of that obligation, is the equivalent, in a sense, to consideration. You are now obligated to bring a korban because you took a neder. The discharging of that obligation is the equivalent of consideration because you've now removed the obligation from you. Same thing here. One is obligated to divorce their wife. So in that case, the divorce of the wife is a discharging of the obligation. The discharge of that obligation in of itself is considered to be consideration because you've freed yourself from the obligation. So those are two ways that Tosafot deals with the problem of consideration here with regards to the Qurban and the Gitei Nashim, to make it equivalent to what we know the halacha is, that only by mecher is duress is considered to be a valid sale, whereas matana under duress is not considered to be a matana. That's number one. Number two is, based on the svara in the end, which it says that if it's rotzeani and I got consideration, that's enough to say that it was done willingly, the Tosafot then says, why do I need the psukim? Why do I need the pasuk by get nashim, and why do I need the pasuk by korban at this point? Because it's all logical. If it's all logical, why do you need a proof from the text? So the Bali Tosafot in the end say, v'yesh lomar, d'ilav kro, without the psukim, avamina, d'afagav, d'gomar, u'makne, even though he concludes, and he's gomer b'libo to be makne, the korban, nevertheless, kevin deino mitretzel, yedei kfiya, since he's only compelled to do that through force, pasul hu legabe mizbeach, it is not valid for the mizbeach, the zevach rishayim hu. It's a zevach that stemmed from a rasha. Because the only reason in the end that he acquiesced to bring the korban is because he was compelled. That's not a type of korban that Hashem wants to see. And therefore, the way that he came to bring the korban is problematic. What the Bali Tosafot is saying is that there's a higher standard by korbanot. That even though here, in terms of a sale and in terms of any other situation, we would consider it to be a valid transaction or valid act because of the fact that you got consideration and you did it willingly after being compelled under duress, those two things married together make it that it is a valid act. But your korban, despite the validity of the act, it's still tainted. It's tainted because something that goes on the mizbeach has a higher standard and we want it to come from a pure place. We have a similar thing with regards to Yeush and Shinoi Rishut. The Rabbeinu Tam says, well, Yeush Vashini Rishut, make it that the item now is in possession of the gazlan, and he should be able to bring it as a korban. Yet we still say that it's a mitzvah baba veira. And that's what the Rabbeinu Tam says, that Yeush Vashini Rishut, that come about because you were makdish the animal, the owners gave up hope of getting it back. Then the gazlan is makdish it. When he's makdish it, that's the Shini Rishut that takes it out of the possession of the balim. The Rabbeinu Tam says, that doesn't work, because if you generated the dusha through an act of gzela, meaning that the shinui reshut is what took it from being gzela to ex-gzela, then that act itself is tainted. That act is tainted that you can't put that animal on mizbeach because it is zevach rishayim or it is a mitzvah haba be'aveira. If the yeush and shinui reshut took place first and then only afterwards are you makdish the animal, that might be okay because the animal's ownership was already changed before you ever got to the world of Kedusha, or the world of the Mizbeach. So just like over there, if the Shinui Rishut is making it Hekdesh, that invalidates it, so too over here. The fact that it was done through Kfiya is what invalidates it, that in and of itself makes it a Pasul Korban, because the means for getting you to agree to give the Korban came about in a way that is not acceptable, at least for the Mizbeach. And that's why we need an extra Pasul to tell you that it is still a valid Korban. Right now, just in a summary, because the Gemara is going to continue here and speak about get gitin that are given under duress, or whether you're allowed to compel people to give a get, which is what's called, otherwise known in halacha, as a get mi'useh, a forced get. Now, why it's important here is because the way the Rambam formulates the giving of a get when one is compelled or hit to give the get, which is all these things like seem like a joke. The guy are hitting him, they're banging away at him, and he gets consideration for it, and he says, "Rotza," and he says, "Ah, see, he did it willingly." How can you claim that a person is doing something willingly when they're being beaten up? So the answer is very famous. The Rambam is, the Rambam in Hilchot Gerushin, Perek Bet, Halacha Chaf, says the following. V'lama lo bitel get zeh? Why is this get not invalid? Shariyu anus. He is being compelled. Ben biyad akum, ben biyad Yisrael. No matter who is causing the duress to force him or compel him to say that he's willing to give a get, why is it considered to be a valid get? Because she'ein omrim anus elami shenilchatz v'nidchak lasot davar she'enu mukhuyav bo min haTorah lasoto. You're only considered to be doing something under duress and not willingly when it's something that you're not compelled to do from the Torah. Kagon, mishuka achimachar ochenatan. Like someone who's compelled to sell or give a gift, even though they don't want to do it. That's considered to be duress. It's very interesting the Rambam says that, because the Rambam in Hilchot Mechira, we'll see in a second, says you can sell under duress. Aval, mishitakafo yitzro hara. Someone who's been captured by their evil inclination, the vatel mitzvah, to nullify a mitzvah, ola sota veira, to do something wrong, vuka achasa davar shechayav lo soto, and we beat him up until now he goes and says, I'll do the right thing, or he now is willing to desist from doing this aveira, ein ze anus, elohu anas atzmo. That's not considered to be duress. We're not causing the duress. The duress is actually him. Bidato ara'a. His evil inclination, his bad thoughts over here, are what are the duress over here. Lefikach, zeh she'eino rotzeh legaresh, nachashu rotzeh liot miYisrael. This person doesn't want a divorce, but he does want to be a good Jew. Rotzeh lasod kol ha-mitzvot, and he really wants to do all the mitzvot, rechek min averot, distance of averot, v'yitzrohu shetekafo. But he's been overtaken by his evil inclination, v'kevin shuka, achet tashash yitzro. So we beat him up until his yetzer no longer has power. We're weakening his yetzer. That rotze ani is basically aligning your inner self with what you should be doing. It's almost like a chassidish avort, the way that the Rambam is explaining it. He's talking about the neshama, or the pure neshama, or the nitzotz of a Jew inside who wants to do the right thing. The neshama is pure and wants to do the right thing. The problem is you have klipot. You have things that are surrounding it. You have a yetzer that's blocking him from doing that. And intellectually, he can't get to where he's supposed to be. So what we do is, by beating him up, we take away those klipot, we take away those inhibitions that are stopping him from doing the right thing. We basically align his internal or inner will with what he's supposed to be doing. And we take away the inhibitors or mitigating factors, and therefore we're aligning. So his rotzani is not saying that I'm doing something against my will. I'm getting to do what is in my will. I remove those things that are against my will. So that's the way that the Rambam phrases it. What's interesting about the Rambam's formulation is over here, we beat him up until he says, Rotzeh ani. If you look in Hilchot Mechira, where he codifies this, aside from the fact that it's also seemingly problematic, because over here he says it doesn't work by Mecher and Natan. So there you have to qualify that or explain that by saying that the Rambam means without money. But for the case where there is money and consideration, it does work. The Rambam in Hilchot Mechira, Perek Yud, Aloch Aleph, says the following. He was compelled to sell something until the point where he took consideration for the property that he sold. Afilu talu, if they're hanging him up, like we said here in the Gemara. His memkar is a good memkar. Whether it's non-real property or real property. Because of the duress, he really concludes that he wants to sell it. What's interesting over here is that he never says you have to say rotzeh ani. He never says you have to say I want to do it. Somebody said if he beats him up and he goes through the transaction, it's enough. So the Achronim point out that that difference in the Rambam is intentional, which is that in cases where we need positive action, then we are going to compel you to say rotzeh ani. In situations where we just need acquiescence, then you don't need rotzeh ani. But the case of the Korban and the case of the Get, we need you to take a positive action. We need you to bring the Korban. We need you to give the Get. Over there, we need rotzeh ani. We need positive affirmation that you're willing to do it. And therefore, we have to compel him until he says rotzeh ani. By the case of Mecher, we don't need positive affirmation. We simply need you to desist from making claims on the land. We simply need you to say, yes, there was a sale, or I'm agreeing to the sale. We don't need you to positively affirm. We simply need you to remove your claims from the property. In that case, we don't need rotzeh ani. We simply need you to go through with the mecher. As long as you've gone through with the transaction, that's enough of an indication that you were a willing participant. Yes, willing because of duress, but the duress made it that you were willing to transact in this case. Over there, we don't need positive affirmation. We simply need that he's willing to go through with the transaction, even though he never explicitly states rotzeh ani, that I want to go through with it. So it's an important distinction within the Rambam, but it derives from over here the difference between the nature of what we're trying to compel him to do. We're trying to compel him to take action. There you'll need positive affirmation of a rotzeh ani. But it's a case where you're compelling him to sell something. You're just trying to have him not act actively, but not stop or agree to the sale. that agreement or that bitul, it's enough if he just agrees to it. He doesn't have to say rotze ani. Okay, we're going to stop here. 8 lines down on the top of Memchet Amud Aleph.